Highbridge Audio presents Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, a fair and balanced look at the right by Al Franken, with Johanna Day, April Yvette Thompson, Andrew Barr, and Brandon Parker Rubin.
A note from the author. Although I wrote this book in a spirit of dispassionate inquiry, I cannot expect my critics to respond in kind. My right-wing detractors will undoubtedly tell you that I'm an obnoxious prick, a smug asshole, a clear and present threat to our national security. I will not stoop to dignify such calumny with a response, except to say that Condoleezza Rice should watch her mouth. More imaginative critics might charge that, like Newt Gingrich, I had an affair with a Supreme Court justice. This kind of attack, which is totally irrelevant to the political content of this book, exposes how desperate my enemies have become. As the great Joseph Walsh said to Joe McCarthy, "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?" Unlike Senator McCarthy and his intellectual heirs Ann Coulter and Howard Stern, I do have a sense of decency. And that is why I've decided to reveal a dirty little secret about this book that my critics are too lazy and stupid to figure out on their own. I proudly acknowledge that I did not write this book alone. No author ever writes a book entirely by himself. That would be impossible. Just ask Dennis Rodman or John Updike. Like making a movie or building a long suspension bridge, writing a book is very much a team effort. And that is why I think it's important to state clearly right up front the methodology used to research this book and to give credit to the ragtag bunch of Harvard misfits I've come to affectionately call Team Franken. It all started when Harvard's Kennedy School of Government asked me to serve as a fellow at the Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. After my varied and celebrated career in television, movies, publishing, and the lucrative world of corporate speaking, being a fellow at Harvard seemed, well, frankly, like a step down. I couldn't think of anything less appealing than molding the minds of tomorrow's leaders, unless it was spending fireside evenings sipping sherry with great minds at the faculty club. Yawn. To my surprise and delight, though, all Harvard wanted me to do was show up every once in a while and write something about something. That gave me an idea. Would it be okay if I wrote a scathingly partisan attack on the right-wing media and the Bush administration? No problem, Harvard said absentmindedly. Count me in, I replied. From now on, call me Professor Franken. No, Harvard said, you're not a professor. But you can run a study group on the topic of your choosing. Great, I said. I've got the perfect topic. Write my son's Harvard College application essay. No, they said. Harvard students already know how to write successful Harvard applications, Al. We want you to teach them something new. Harvard was right where I wanted it. How about if the topic is how to research my book? Sure, Harvard said. Most of our professors teach that course. Why, in the biochemistry department, most of the graduate-level courses are... Harvard was boring me. I gotta run, Harvard. Thanks. From among the 700 students who applied for my study group, I chose 14 intellectual heavyweights. Some undergraduates, some from the prestigious Kennedy School of Government, and one from the Harvard School of Dentistry, just in case. This was Team Franken. Like the X-Men, each had his own special power, and each had a story. There was Bridger McGaw, a Gore campaign veteran still sore from getting burned in Florida. Madhu Chug, with a mind as insatiable as her name was unpronounceable. Emmy Berning, an ultra-feminist with a stunning resume and a figure to match. Ben Kane and Ben Wickler, the Bens, Team Franken's gay gladiators, whose fierce love for each other fueled their ceaseless advocacy of justice for gays lesbians, the transgendered, bisexuals, and man-on-dog enthusiasts, such as Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, and the rest. There were 14 in all, tough, smart, and deeply committed to coming to my Cambridge apartment once a week to eat a delicious hot meal cooked by my wife, Franny. I felt like I had 14 children, my 14 Harvard research assistants. And like every good parent, I loved each in a different way. Some I loved like the irrepressibly mischievous child who doesn't do his homework. Others I loved like the good, deserving child who does all of his homework, mows the lawn, and ghostwrites the chapters. And still others I loved more than the rest. The way a parent secretly chooses favorites and undermines the self-confidence of the others. No, I wasn't a perfect leader, but what counts for me, and I hope for you, the listener, is that this book brings to a new level the politics of personal destruction that have come to define our era. Because with 14 researchers, I could do something that my targets seem incapable of doing. Get my facts straight. Nothing highlighted the need for painstaking research and fact-checking more than the hiring process itself, which I had conducted on the basis of hearsay and guesswork. For example, the Bens turned out not to be gay, and one, Owen, wasn't even named Ben. Thanks to Team Franken, you can rest assured that almost every fact in this book is correct. Either that or it's a joke. If you think you found something that rings untrue, you've probably just missed a hilarious joke and should blame yourself rather than me or Team Franken. Enjoy. Introduction. God chose me to write this book. Just the fact that you are listening to this is proof not just of God's existence, but also of his, her, its beneficence. That's right, I am not certain of God's precise gender, but I am certain that he, she, it chose me to write this book. This isn't hubris. I'm not saying this in an egotistical way. God didn't choose me because I'm the greatest writer who ever lived. That was William Shakespeare, whose work I have a passing familiarity with. No, I just happen to be the right vessel at the right time. If something in this book makes you laugh, it was God's joke. If something makes you think, it was because God had a good point to make. The reason I know God chose me is because God spoke to me personally. God began our conversation by clearing something up. Some of George W. Bush's friends say that Bush believes God called him to be president during these times of trial. But God told me that he, she, it had actually chosen Al Gore by making sure that Gore won the popular vote and, God thought, the Electoral College.
That worked for everyone else, God said.
What about Tilden, I asked, referring to the 1876 debacle.
Quiet!
God snapped. God was angry. God said that after 9/11, George W. Bush squandered a unique moment of national unity. That instead of rallying the country around a program of mutual purpose and sacrifice, Bush cynically used the tragedy to solidify his political power and pursue an agenda that panders to his base and serves the interest of his corporate backers. God told me that Bush squandered a $4.6 trillion surplus and is plunging us into deficits as far as God can see, and that Bush squandered another surplus, the surplus of goodwill from the rest of the world that he had inherited from Bill Clinton. And this was pissing God off. He, she, it was right. But it sounded like a lot of work. Look, God, I'm flattered, but I think you got the wrong guy. The kind of book you're talking about would require months of research. And God said,
let there be Google, and let there be LexisNexis.
Very funny, God. I use Google all the time.
Yes, I know,
God said.
For hot Asian teens.
Oh, you must be thinking of my son, Joe.
Al, I'm omniscient.
Okay, I changed the subject. It's just that I can't do this book by myself.
Leave that to me,
God boomed. And that's when Harvard called. I had my Nexus, I had my Google, I had my Harvard Fellowship, and I had my 14 research assistants. I sat down to write. Nothing. So I got on my knees and prayed for guidance. How, God, can I best do your work through this book? Who, dear Lord, is the audience for a book like this? And what's a good title? God answered,
You know those shitty books by Ann Coulter and Bernie Goldberg?
The bestsellers that claim there's a liberal bias in the media, I asked.
Total bullshit,
God said.
Start by attacking them. He's clearly a disgruntled former employee, and she just lies. By the way, there's something seriously wrong with her.
Well, that's pretty obvious, God.
So, go after them, the whole liberal bias myth, and then go after the right-wing media, especially Fox.
Okay, God, I'm writing this down.
Then use them as a jumping-off point to go after Bush. You know, big tax cuts for the rich, surging unemployment, ignoring everyone but his corporate buddies, screwing the environment, pissing off the rest of the world. That stuff. And that's your book.
Well, I got it. One last thing. Title.
How about Bearers of False Witness and the False Witness That They Bear?
Okay, yeah, I'll work with that. Chapter 1. Hummus. Asking whether there is a liberal or conservative bias to the mainstream media is a little like asking whether Al-Qaeda uses too much oil in their hummus. The problem with Al-Qaeda is that they're trying to kill us. The right-wing media tells us constantly that the problem with the mainstream media is that it has a liberal bias. I don't think it does. But there are other far more important biases in the mainstream media than liberal or conservative ones. Most of these biases stem from something called the profit motive. This is why we often see a bias toward the sensational, involving scandal and hopefully sex or violence or please, please, please both. And there's the easy and cheap to cover bias, which is why almost all political coverage is about process and horse race and not about policy. Why have an in-depth report on school vouchers when two pundits who've spent 5 minutes in the green room looking over a couple of articles Xeroxed by an intern can just scream at each other about the issue on the air? There's the get-it-first bias. Remember the 2000 election? I believe there were some problems there associated with that one. Pack mentality, negativity, soft news, the don't-offend-the-conglomerate-that-owns-us bias, and, of course, the ever-present bias of hoping there's a war to cover. Does the mainstream media have a liberal bias? On a couple things, maybe. Compared to the American public at large, probably a slightly higher percentage of journalists, because of their enhanced power of discernment, realize that they know a gay person or two and are therefore less frightened of them. By the same token, I'll bet the media were biased during the Scopes monkey trial. But they were professionals and gave the Noah's Ark side a fair shake. But to believe there is a liberal political bias in the mainstream media, you'd have to be either not paying attention or just very susceptible to repetition. Yes, we've heard it over and over and over again. For decades, the media elite is an arm of the Democratic National Committee. Anyone notice the mainstream media's coverage of Clinton? For 18 months, it was all Monica all the time. There were just a few news organizations that did not succumb to this temptation, and I like to cite them whenever I can. Sailing Magazine, American Grocer Monthly, Jugs, and Big Butt, which is ironic because I thought Big Butt had a story. But how about the 2000 presidential campaign? Remember, in the first debate, Al Gore said he had gone down to a disaster site in Texas with Federal Emergency Management Agency Director James Lee Witt. Actually, it turned out that he had gone to that disaster with a deputy of James Lee Witt's, As vice president, Gore had gone to 17 other disasters with James Lee Witt, but not that one. The press jumped all over him. There were scores of stories written about how Gore had lied about James Lee Witt. It was as if James Lee Witt had been the most popular man in the United States of America, and Gore was lying just to get some of that James Lee Witt magic to rub off on him. Now contrast that with the media's reaction to this Bush description of his tax cut in the very same debate. Bush said, "I also dropped the bottom rate from 15% to 10% because by far the vast majority of the help goes to the people at the bottom end of the economic ladder. By far, the vast majority goes to the people at the bottom." That is what George W. Bush told America. The truth is that the bottom 60% got 14.7% of that tax cut. Gee, that's a pretty significant misstatement, don't you think? More important than whether Texas Fire was one of the 17 disasters you went to with American icon James Lee Witt. So what was the reaction of the liberal mainstream press? Nothing. Do I believe this is because the mainstream media has a conservative bias? No. I just think the attitude of the press was, he doesn't know. He doesn't know. Leave the man alone. He doesn't know. But of course he did, which is why George W. Bush says he doesn't mind being misunderestimated, because by misunderestimated, Bush means being underestimated for the wrong reason. The media thought he was kind of stupid. He isn't. He's just shamelessly dishonest. The mainstream media does not have a liberal bias. And for all their other biases mentioned above, the mainstream media, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, The New York Times, The Washington Post, Time, Newsweek, and the rest, at least try to be fair. However, there is a right-wing media. You know who they are: Fox News, The Washington Times, The New York Post, the editorial pages of The Wall Street Journal, talk radio. They are biased, and they have an agenda. The members of the right-wing media are not interested in conveying the truth. That's not what they're for. They're an indispensable component of the right-wing machine that has taken over our country. They employ a tried-and-true methodology. First, they concoct an inflammatory story that serves their political goals. Al Gore is a liar. They repeat it. Al Gore lies again. They embellish it. Are his lies pathological, or are they merely malicious? They try to push it into the mainstream media. All too often, they succeed. Tall tales. Is what we've got here a compulsion to exaggerate? New York Times, October 15th, 2000. Occasionally, they fail. Despite their efforts, the mainstream media never picked up the Clinton as murderer stories. But even their failures serve their agenda as evidence of liberal bias. Win-win. You've got to admit, it's a good racket. They use these tactics to cripple Clinton's presidency. They use them to discredit Gore and put Bush into office. And they're using them now to silence Bush's critics. Bush is getting away with murder, just like Clinton did. See, that's how insidious the right-wing modus operandi is. Even I bought into the Clinton murder thing there for a second. And that's my point. We have to be vigilant. And we have to be more than vigilant. We have to fight back. We have to expose those who bear false witness for the false witness bearers that they are. And we have to do it in a straightforward, plain-spoken way. Let's call them what they are. Liars. Lying, lying liars. Hence the title of this book. Al Franken tells it like it is. Chapter 2. Ann Coulter, Nutcase. I know, you think the chapter title's a little harsh, but believe me, in Coulter's case, Nutcase is more than justified. I should know. You see, Ann and I are friends. I personally wasn't aware of that myself until I read it in the New York Observer. They did a profile of Coulter when her bile-filled, relentlessly ugly bestseller Slander topped the New York Times bestseller list. And for some reason, I guess to establish her bona fides as just a lovable gal about town, she told the writer from the Observer that she was, quote, friendly with Al Franken. I found that odd. I have met Ann Coulter once at a Saturday Night Live party when she introduced herself to me. I made what in retrospect was a terrible mistake. Instead of saying, Ann Coulter, you're a horrible person. Ooh, I just hate you, or something along those lines. Instead, I was cordial for maybe a minute or two. That is the sum total of my personal interaction with Ann Coulter. And yet, to her, it was enough to include me in a very short list of people she's, quote, friendly with. Pathetic, to be sure, but no more dishonest than every other word that comes out of this woman. Coulter, for those of you lucky enough not to have been exposed to her, is the reigning diva of the hysterical right, or rather the hysterical diva of the reigning right. Coulter has appeared on shows like ABC's This Week, Good Morning America, Hardball, Larry King Live, and The Today Show to complain, among other things, that conservatives don't get on TV enough. Her books, like her TV appearances, consist of nonstop rabid frothing. Her first, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Case Against Bill Clinton, put her on the radar as an up-and-coming liar. Her next book, Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right, argues that liberals use lies and shrill accusations to debase political discourse in America. It's a fascinating exercise in dishonesty, hypocrisy, and irony of the unintentional sort. Let's get right to some examples. And there are examples and examples and examples. Take the dramatic conclusion of Slander. After 206 pages of accusing liberals of, among other awful things, being elitist snobs, she trots out her crowning piece of evidence, proof of the New York Times' disregard and contempt for what real Americans care about. The day after seven-time NASCAR Winston Cup champion Dale Earnhardt died in a race at the Daytona 500, almost every newspaper in America carried the story on the front page. Stock car racing had been the nation's fastest-growing sport for a decade, and NASCAR the second-most-watched sport behind the NFL. More Americans recognize the name Dale Earnhardt than, say, Maureen Dowd. Manhattan liberals are dumbly blinking at that last sentence. It took the New York Times 2 days to deem Earnhardt's death sufficiently important to mention it on the first page. Demonstrating the left's renowned populist touch, the article began, quote, his death brought a silence to the Walmart. The Times went on to report that in vast swaths of the country, people watched stock car racing. Tacky people were mourning Dale Earnhardt all over the South. Pretty powerful indictment, I have to admit. No mention for 2 days. One small problem. Dale Earnhardt died on February 18th, 2001. On February 19th, 2001, which by my calculation is the next day, the Times ran a front-page account of Earnhardt's death written by sports writer Robert Lipsight under the headline, Stock Car Star Killed on Last Lap of Daytona 500. Frankly, I think the fact that the New York Times did have a front-page article on the Dale Earnhardt story the day after he died kind of undercuts her point that they didn't, don't you? I mean, if they didn't, that would have been something, huh? But they did. And by the way, that article that Coulter refers to, the one 2 days later, it was by Rick Bragg, a Pulitzer Prize winner who grew up in Piedmont, Alabama. Boy, I hate those Piedmont snobs. It's always Piedmont has the best this and Piedmont has the best that. Yeah, well, fuck you, Piedmont. Where did Ann Coulter come from? Well, she's a lawyer, one of the elves who helped Paula Jones go after Bill Clinton. That's a feather in her cap. She was born in 1961 or 1963, depending on whether you believe her Connecticut driver's license, 1961, or her newer D.C. driver's license, 1963. The Washington Post looked into this, and Ann claims the D.C. license is correct, which means that when she registered to vote, she was 16. The Post checked with the New Canaan, Connecticut registrar's office. That, of course, would be voter fraud. Either way, she lied on at least one of her driver's licenses, a government ID, which is a violation of federal law under the Patriot Act. I believe she could be locked up indefinitely for that without being allowed to talk to a lawyer or a judge or Paula Zahn. Now, lots of women lie about their age, but it does raise a concern about Coulter if that really is her name. Coulter's misstatements about her age make us question the veracity of the seemingly factual statements in her book, such as, "Liberals hate America. Liberals hate all religions except Islam. Democrats actually hate working-class people. Liberals hate society. Even Islamic terrorists don't hate America like liberals do. Democrats will destroy anyone who stands in their way. All that matters to them is power. Liberals can't just come out and say they want to take more of our money, kill babies, and discriminate on the basis of race. Liberals seek to destroy sexual differentiation in order to destroy morality. That's the whole point of being a liberal, to feel superior to people with less money. Liberals are crazy." All this seems the slightest bit odd, considering that the first line of the first page of Slander is, "Political debate in this country has become insufferable." And she explains, "Instead of actual debate about ideas and issues with real consequence, the country is trapped in a political discourse that resembles professional wrestling." So what is Coulter's contribution to civilizing our political discourse? Well, in the entire 206 pages, she never actually makes a case for any conservative issue. Not school vouchers, not supply-side tax cuts, not privatization of Social Security. The entire book is filled with distortions, factual errors, and vicious invective, slander, if you will, bolstered by the shoddiest research this side of the Hitler diaries. Take, for example, this gem from page 68. To support her claim that the mainstream media is in the hands of lefties, Coulter makes the point that Newsweek Washington bureau chief Evan Thomas is, quote, "the son of Norman Thomas, a four-time socialist candidate for president." Actually, Norman Thomas was a socialist candidate six times, running first in 1928 with a radical proposal for something called Social Security. It's odd that Coulter understates the number of times that Thomas was the Socialist Party nominee, because that would make her argument that much stronger if Norman Thomas had been Evan Thomas's father, which he was not. Now, in fairness to Coulter, this kind of research is tough to do. I asked Team Franken how someone might be able to find out something like that. There were a number of suggestions: Google search, Nexus search, go into the New York Times archives for the obit. Then one of the kids hit on a simple yet quite brilliant idea. Why not call Evan Thomas? Just for future reference, Anne, here's a transcript of my call with Evan Thomas. "Evan, thank you for taking my call." "No problem, Al. What's up?" "Was Norman Thomas your father?" "No." That sounds simple enough, but to protect my reputation for thoroughness, I didn't let Evan off the hook quite so fast. "Are you sure?" "Yes." "And your father, what was his name?" "Evan Thomas Sr. I'm a junior." "Uh-huh. And your father, Evan Thomas Sr., did he ever run for president?" "No, he was in publishing." "And you're sure?" "Yes. Al, is this about that Ann Coulter thing?" "Yeah." I heard about that. Is there something wrong with her?" "Yes, there is. Particularly considering that when going after the book publishing industry, Coulter complains that, quote, liberal jeremiads make it to print without the most cursory fact-checking." Which reminds me, I really should be fact-checking this thing as I go along. Actually, I do take great pains in my research. In my last book of this nature, a little number one New York Times bestseller entitled "Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations," only one claim was arguably inaccurate, and I am pleased to be the first person to point it out publicly. In writing the book, I cited preliminary findings from a study by Kathleen Hall Jamieson regarding the political literacy of radio talk show listeners. In the final version of the study, the findings showed that people who listened regularly to political talk radio were able to identify the president more frequently than I had given them credit for. I regret the error. But even John Fund, Limbaugh's ghostwriter on The Way Things Ought to Be, acknowledged to me a bit grudgingly that I had done an honest, though thoroughly vicious job on his guy. Coulter, however, has spawned a cottage industry of slander debunkers, some of whom, DailyHowler.com, Spinsanity.org, and Salon, I'm cribbing from. Coulter's defense, heard in countless appearances on talk shows, is, I have footnotes, or there are 35 pages of footnotes, or I have 780 footnotes, or it's in the footnotes. There's a big emphasis on footnotes, which brings me to how to lie with footnotes. How to lie with footnotes number one. Don't have footnotes. Ann Coulter doesn't have 780 footnotes in slander. She has zero footnotes. None. Not one footnote. She does have 35 pages of endnotes. Footnotes are easy to reference. They're at the bottom or the foot of the page. Endnotes are much harder to reference. If you're using your, quote, footnotes to lie, make them endnotes. How to lie with footnotes number two. Have 780 of them. Coulter knows that her readers, the ones who buy her books out of an obsessive need to read stuff that reconfirms everything they already know or think they know, are probably not going to check one, let alone 780 of her endnotes. Let me illustrate how Coulter exploits this simple principle of lying with footnotes, endnotes, from page 12 of Slander. This is a good one, and in a way sort of sums up everything you need to know. After Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion contrary to the clearly expressed position of the New York Times editorial page, the Times responded with an editorial on Thomas titled, The Youngest, Cruelest Justice. That was actually the headline on a lead editorial in the newspaper of record. Thomas is not engaged on the substance of his judicial philosophy. He is called a colored lawn jockey for conservative white interests, race traitor, black snake, chicken and biscuit-eating Uncle Tom, house Negro and handkerchief head, Benedict Arnold and Judas Iscariot. All this from the tireless opponents of intolerance. Okay, what percentage of Coulter's readers do you suppose read this and thought, my God, the New York Times called Clarence Thomas a chicken and biscuit-eating Uncle Tom? I knew the Times was bad, but I never dreamed it was this bad. What, high 90s? And what percentage do you think bothered to go to the back of her book and wade through the endnotes to discover the quotes came from a Playboy interview with former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders and from a black leader at a meeting of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference that was quoted in The New Yorker? The key here, of course, is the sleight of hand that deliberately leads gullible readers to the conclusion that the Times called Clarence Thomas a colored lawn jockey. This should tell us a couple things about Ann Coulter. First, she's dishonest, no surprise there. But more importantly, it shows the contempt she holds for her own readers. How to lie with footnotes number three. Cite a source, but totally misrepresent what it says. She really works this one into the ground. Early in the book, she writes, New York Times columnist Frank Rich demanded that Ashcroft stop monkeying around with Muslim terrorists and concentrate on anti-abortion extremists. Except he didn't. In the column, written during the anthrax scare, Rich simply criticized Ashcroft's refusal to meet with Planned Parenthood, which has had years of experience with terrorism in the form of bombings and sniper attacks from pro-life extremists. The piece doesn't include the words monkeying or Islamic or Muslim or make any suggestion that the Justice Department abandoned its efforts against Al-Qaeda. Coulter pulls this wild distortion, like so very, very many, directly out of her ass. Just another quick one. On page 118 And by the way, when you see Coulter on TV, interviewers never ask her about anything past page 12. You've got to give me credit for being able to stomach the entire screed. Anyway, on page 118, she writes that when the media consortium study on the 2000 Florida vote was released, it showed that, quote, Bush had won on any count. But the Washington Post story she cites says that, quote, study finds Gore might have won statewide tally of all uncounted ballots. Now, that was actually part of the headline of the story. Don't you go to hell for this stuff? How to lie with footnotes number 4. Use the any words written in a newspaper can be attributed to that newspaper technique. This can also be used to defame newscasts and magazines to show just how much the media elite hates Christians. Coulter writes, for decades, the New York Times has allowed loose associations between Nazis and Christians to be made in its pages. Statements like these were not uncommon. Quote, did the Nazi crimes draw on Christian tradition? And, quote, the church is co-responsible for the Holocaust. Okay, the first quote, did the Nazi crimes draw on Christian tradition, is from a 2001 book review. The Times reviewer, Paul Berman, was framing the question asked by the book he was reviewing, which was about a 400-year-old play performed annually in Bavaria that portrays Jews as hateful and evil, which, for the record, we are not. The second quote is a quote of a quote from a 1998 Times article, John Paul's Jewish Dilemma. The writer for the Times isn't saying that the church is co-responsible for the Holocaust. He's quoting a critic of the church. In the same article, a Jewish historian is also quoted as saying that, quote, Pope Pius saved 750,000 Jews. You really have to keep on your toes with Anne. In her next book, Coulter will probably write, Al Franken says Jews are hateful and evil. Look for the end note. How to lie with footnotes number 5, overload a LexisNexis search. For those of you unfamiliar with LexisNexis, it is a state-of-the-art research tool, journalistic crutch. Like any powerful instrument, LexisNexis searches can be manipulated to produce misleading results. It's like a chainsaw, which can be used productively, say as a prop in a movie like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but can also be used for evil, such as in an actual chainsaw massacre. Throughout this book, I use LexisNexis productively. In Slander, Coulter uses it to dismember the truth. Introducing the overloaded LexisNexis search. On page 8 of Slander, Coulter refers to a controversial 1994 Christmas Day speech given by Jesse Jackson on British TV. Quote, the New York Times did not report the speech, she complains. Checking the endnote reveals her methodology. LexisNexis search of New York Times archives from December 1994 through January 1995 for Jesse Jackson and Germany and fascism and South America produces no documents. Well, yeah. A more reasonable search, Jesse Jackson and Christmas and Britain, shows that, yes, of course, the New York Times did run an article on December 20th about the controversy using excerpts of Jackson's speech, which was pre-recorded. Using Coulter's technique, I can prove that no newspaper has ever covered anything. For example, I can prove the Washington Times did not cover the incident in which George H.W. Bush threw up on the Japanese prime minister. A LexisNexis search from January 1992 for Bush and Japan and prime minister and lap and cookies and tossed produced no documents. How to lie with footnotes number 6. Just make shit up. From page 134 of Slander, quote, even during the media's nightly flogging of Iran-Contra, Reagan's approval ratings fell only 5 percentage points, from 80% to 75%. The endnote cites a Christian Science Monitor article from January 7, 1987. The article reports that, quote, in last month's Gallup poll, Reagan's approval rating fell from 63% to 47%. And remember, this is from people who are not only Christian, but also scientists. So that's how you lie with footnotes. Disgusting, huh? But it's not just you who think so. Even people Coulter considers friends say she's a lying bitch. 2. A horror of epic proportions. 3. Oh, the poor thing. 4. And a bitch. 5. Those are my little footnotes. 2 is me to my wife. 3. Ibid. 4. My wife to me. 5. Me to another friend. Chapter 3. You know who I don't like? Ann Coulter. I'm sorry to do this to you, but I've just left so much good stuff out of the previous chapter. I told a friend that going after Coulter is like shooting fish in a barrel. He said, I've never shot fish in a barrel, but I could imagine that after a while it could get boring. So I'll try to keep this short. First, a few more highlights. After 9/11, she wrote in her column, which now appears on the prestigious internet, we should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. In the very same New York Observer article in which she called me a friend, Coulter joked to the reporter, quote, my only regret with Timothy McVeigh is he did not go to the New York Times building, unquote. Get it? To show there were no hard feelings, the Times invited her to comment on the Trent Lott controversy. She responded, quote, I don't remember liberals being this indignant about the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Remember, this is coming from a woman who says, quote, political debate in this country is insufferable. It's all liberals' fault, unquote. Coulter believes that the rules don't apply to her. Anything she accuses liberals of doing, she can do herself in spades. Take her chapter, The Joy of Arguing with Liberals, You're Stupid. The premise, quote, if liberals were prevented from ever again calling Republicans dumb, they would be robbed of half their arguments. This is how six-year-olds argue. They call everything stupid, unquote. Let's look at some of the arguments this grown-up makes. Christy Whitman is a, quote, bird brain. Katie Couric is, quote, an airhead. Adlai Stevenson was a boob. Gerald Ford was a little dumb. New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson is truly stupid. Oh, in addition to being a bird brain, Christy Whitman is also a dimwit. Maine Senator Susan Collins is a halfwit. And so is halfwit Jim Jeffords, the Vermont senator who defected from the Republican Party. He is also, quote, D-U-M-M dumb. What really burns Coulter is that in fawning liberal media, quote, Jim Jeffords' degree from Yale cannot be cited often enough, and consider that Jeffords got into Yale long before the terrorizing regime of the SATs, back when admission to the Ivy Leagues turned on social class rather than standardized tests. Quick, Yale. Low SATs, social class. You thinking about who I'm thinking about? Yet on page 33, how does Coulter answer people who think our president may not be the brightest star in the firmament? Why, he, quote, graduated from Yale College and Harvard Business School, unquote. So consistency is not the woman's strong point. Take, for example, chapter 2, quote, the Gucci position on domestic policy, where we're told that, quote, liberals thrive on the attractions of snobbery, and that Democrats actually hate working-class people. Later, Coulter calls the phrase working families, quote, a euphemism for families in which no one works. Does that seem maybe the tiniest bit elitist to you? And can you imagine just how hard Ann Coulter works? It takes time and effort to find stuff to take out of context, to make up or distort things that the New York Times did or did not print, to devise overloaded nexus searches, to... Wait a minute, no, that's wrong. I've been doing a lot of fact-checking and such, or at least Team Franken has, and by God, it's a lot more work than just making shit up. No, come to think of it, Coulter's just plain lazy. But then again, like any movement conservative, Coulter is a firm believer in the free market. By definition, anything that succeeds in the marketplace of ideas, like her books, must inherently be of value. And therefore, unlike members of working families, she really does work for a living. Here's something to think about, though. A friend of mine works in the hotel industry. About 65% of the movies that are ordered in hotels are adult movies. Clearly, two blondes going down on each other is a real winner in the marketplace of ideas. Now, my all-time favorite stat. The average length of time that those movies are on is 12 minutes. That is my favorite statistic in life. What Coulter writes is political pornography. She aims directly at a reader's basest instincts. Pornography may serve as a welcome release for Republican businessmen on the road and as a profit center for Marriott, Hyatt, Sheraton, Radisson, and other big GOP donors, but it doesn't pretend to be something it's not. That's why the titles don't appear on your bill. Though it may surprise you, I have a great deal of respect for many conservatives in the media. Terry Bradshaw, for example. And what shocked me most following the publication of Slander was the silence from those conservatives who complain about the ugliness of political discourse in this country. Liberals don't hate America. We love America more than Ann Coulter does. I love it enough to engage my readers honestly. As I was putting this book to bed, Coulter's new book, Treason, Liberal Treachery from the Cold War to the War on Terrorism, slithered onto the shelves. All indications are that it will be a bestseller. Based on Team Franken's preliminary analysis, I can tell you she's done it again. But in lieu of a full-blown dissection, for now I will dispense with treason with a limerick. A woman named Coulter cried treason. She did it without any reason. Though we know that she lied, 'twas perhaps justified. On her brain, I'm afraid, there's a lesion. I'm sorry if that sounds a little cheap, but I just couldn't find a rhyme for Julius Rosenberg. Chapter 4. Liberals Who Hate America. In December of 2000, I did the second of three USO tours I've done because, you know, I hate America. And this one, I happened to be traveling with John Glenn. And part of the trip, we landed on the deck of the aircraft carrier, the USS Truman, named for our 33rd president, a liberal America hater of the worst sort. There's just one reference to Truman in Coulter's book, Slander. Quote, Truman got the country into Korea and couldn't get us out for 2.5 years. That's it. No Truman Doctrine, no Marshall Plan, no NATO. John F. Kennedy receives a similarly fleeting mention. Quote, Kennedy got the country into a war in Vietnam after the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion and then sat passively by while the Russians built the Berlin Wall, unquote. FDR gets whacked around a bit because he, quote, spent 8 years failing to get the country out of the Depression, but then had the skill and foresight to allow the nation to be taken by surprise at Pearl Harbor, unquote. That's all we get on Roosevelt, except that he called Stalin Uncle Joe. She's tough on us Democrats and our, quote, beloved Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan, however, single-handedly won the Cold War. In fact, Reagan won the Cold War on page 33, the same page on which Bush graduated from Yale College and Harvard Business School, on page 34, on page 124, then again on 130, 131, 134, and finally again on page 197. If Ann Coulter were genuinely interested in finding out who single-handedly won the Cold War, she should have called my old friend Marshal Viktor Kulikov, the former Warsaw Pact commander. In 1992, Kulikov told U.S. News and World Report that, quote, Reagan was a logical extension of what had started with Truman, a concentrated effort to weaken and intimidate the Soviet Union, unquote. Other people give credit for ending the Cold War to the Polish Pope John Paul II, to Lech Walesa and his independent trade union, Solidarity, to Jimmy Carter, who put pressure on Moscow to respect the human rights of its people, and to the Soviet Union itself, which was collapsing under the crushing weight of its own failed system. Reagan, of course, did put the medium-range Pershing II missiles in Europe and began developing the Rube Goldberg Star Wars missile defense system, which protects us to this day. So credit where credit is due. Victor told me that Reagan's aggressive posture unquestionably hastened the inevitable collapse of the Soviet Union by a week to 10 days. Personally, I believe it was the Beatles who set the whole thing in motion. Once the White Album made it over the border, hidden in the false bottom of an Aeroflot pilot's briefcase, it was only a matter of time. You do a lot of traveling on USO tours. John Glenn and I flew to Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany, to Aviano Air Base in Italy, to the Truman somewhere in the Mediterranean, and to Eagle Base in Tuzla, Bosnia, Camp Able Sentry in Macedonia, and Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo. At each stop, I entertained the troops with anti-American jokes. I got to spend a lot of time with Senator Glenn and his wife, Annie. I'd kid him a lot whenever we'd be taking off in some cargo plane or helicopter. I'd say, "So, John, you nervous?" He'd laugh, and as I, a fellow Democrat, began to gain his trust, Glenn opened up to me about just how much he hates America. I mean, by Coulter's standards, he had been an extremely liberal senator, pro-union, pro-choice, pro-Social Security, pro-Medicare, you know, all those anti-American things. On the flight from Europe back to Andrews Air Force Base, I asked him, "John, tell me, are you kind of embarrassed about the 59 missions you flew as a Marine pilot in World War II, and the 90 combat missions you flew in Korea, and the 5 Distinguished Flying Crosses and 19 Air Medals you earned?" "Yeah," he cringed. "I'd just as soon not be reminded of all that." "How about being the first American to orbit the Earth?" "It makes me ashamed just to think about it," he said, bowing his head as we touched down at Andrews. Whenever I think back to that day and Glenn's slumped, heaving shoulders, Annie vainly trying to comfort him, I'm always amazed at just how large a burden one man can bear for all the things he has done for the country he hates. Chapter 5. Loving America the Al Franken Way. If you listen to a lot of conservatives, they'll tell you that the difference between them and us is that conservatives love America and liberals hate America, that we blame America first, that we're suspicious of patriotism and always think our country's in the wrong. As conservative radio and TV personality Sean Hannity says, we liberals, quote, train our children to criticize America, not celebrate it. They don't get it. We love America just as much as they do, but in a different way. You see, they love America the way a 4-year-old loves her mommy. Liberals love America like grown-ups. To a 4-year-old, everything mommy does is wonderful, and anyone who criticizes mommy is bad. Grown-up love means actually understanding what you love, taking the good with the bad, and helping your loved one grow. Love takes attention and work and is the best thing in the world. That's why we liberals want America to do the right thing. We know America is the hope of the world, and we love it and want it to do well. We also want it to do good. When liberals look back on history, we see things we're very proud of, and we also see some things which might have seemed like good ideas at the time but turned out to be mistakes. And some things we did, well, they were just bad. That doesn't keep us from loving our country. It's part of loving our country. It's called honesty. What do you think is more important to a loving relationship, honesty or lies? Here's what I mean. I've made a list that takes a good, hard, if very quick look at our nation's history, pointing out the good and owning up to the bad. It's not meant to be a complete list. For example, I've left out the Gadsden Purchase of 1849, which was something of a mixed blessing. The list is more a bittersweet love song to the world's only remaining superpower, that majestic, though slightly flawed, country that I call home. Salem Witch Trials, bad. Revolutionary War, good. Slavery, bad. Ending slavery, good but hard. Civil War reenactments, weird. Massacring Native Americans and breaking our treaties with them, bad. Indian casinos, question mark. Child labor during the Industrial Revolution, bad. Child labor mowing lawns and babysitting, character building. Labor movement creating the weekend, good. Land-grant universities, hot. Rural electrification, hotter. Social Security, hottest. Dictating pop culture for the world? Mixed. Selling Saddam Hussein chemical weapons in the 80s? In retrospect, bad. Louisiana Purchase? Bargain. Grand Canyon? Wonderful, though we really can't take much credit for it. No, wait. National Park System? Really good. Leading Human Genome Project? Probably good. Genetically engineering super race of unstoppable killers? Bad, but probably inevitable. Winning World War II? Wow. Creating democracy in post-war Germany and Japan, laying groundwork for European peace and prosperity in the second half of the 20th century? Right on. The greatest generation? Greatest. Liberty? Good. Justice for all? Would be nice. Bill of Rights? Great, but the Second Amendment could have been clearer. Putting man on the moon? Awesome, if true. Supporting vile dictatorships in Iran, Indonesia, Iraq, Dominican Republic, Guatemala, Congo, Paraguay, Haiti, El Salvador, Bolivia? Bad. Parades? Wholesome fun for the whole family. Gay parades? Exuberant expressions of individuality, often featuring highly imaginative floats and costumes. Conducting horrific medical experiments on African Americans in Tuskegee? Bad. Japanese internment camps? Good. Wait, what were those? Truman Doctrine? Smart. Vietnam? Mistake. Winning Cold War? Credit all around to post-war Republican and Democratic presidents alike. Gross human rights violations in the name of winning the Cold War? Credit all around, except to Jimmy Carter. Women getting the vote? Good. For women. Just kidding. It's good for everybody. African Americans getting the vote? Good. For African Americans. Kidding again. Good for Democrats. Making mistakes? Bad, but inevitable. Correcting mistakes? Good, but not inevitable. Calling those who point out mistakes unpatriotic? Itself unpatriotic. Owning up to our mistakes? Brave. America? Home of the brave. Chapter 6. I Bitch Slap Bernie Goldberg. In January of 2003, I was asked to appear on the MSNBC show Donahue with Bernard Goldberg, the former CBS correspondent whose bestseller Bias, a CBS insider exposes how the media distorts the news, purports to take on the liberal media bias. Slander and bias are the right's 1-2 punch against the effete lefty elite. The Donahue show is going to be taped live in front of a studio audience at Rockefeller Center in New York. I was in San Francisco making big money with one of my hilarious and well-received corporate speeches, and I hate appearing on these shows via satellite. It puts you at such a disadvantage. Still, I had read Bernie's book a few months earlier, and I had a few problems with it, so I said yes. A couple weeks after I did the show, I was stopped by a TV news producer who's not from CBS, who said, "Man, you really bitch-slapped Bernie Goldberg." Yeah, I did, but I have to admit I did it a little unfairly. I ambushed Bernie with his own book. I asked him about something from his chapter, Liberal Hate Speech. Kind of culturesque, don't you think? In the chapter, he cites 12 examples of, quote, liberal hate speech from the past 12 years. Goldberg admits he got them from the Media Research Center, a right-wing media watch group, which sends out a regular newsletter chock full of outrageous quotes from the liberal media. Now, considering the hundreds of thousands of hours of mainstream media coverage over that period, you'd think Goldberg would have some pretty choice examples to pick from, right? One of the 12 examples was a quote from John Chancellor, the late revered NBC anchor and commentator. Here's how it appeared in Bias. "It's short of soap, so there are lice in hospitals. It's short of pantyhose, so women's legs go bare. It's short of snowsuits, so babies stay home in winter. Sometimes it's short of cigarettes, so millions of people stop smoking involuntarily. It drives everyone crazy. The problem isn't communism. No one even talked about communism this week. The problem is shortages. NBC Nightly News commentator John Chancellor on the Soviet Union, August 21, 1991. After presenting the quote, Goldberg tears Chancellor a new one for his, quote, absurd observation that the problem in the old Soviet Union wasn't communism, but shortages. The quote was from August 1991. So on Donahue, I read the quote, then asked, Bernie, do you know what happened that day in the Soviet Union? He froze, then came back with a good one. Why don't you tell me? I learned how to handle that trick in the schoolyard back in Minnesota. No, I said, why don't you tell me? Clearly, the man had no idea. I persisted. What happened in the Soviet Union that day? Bernie went white. Finally, well, I don't know what happened that day. So I told him, let's go to the videotape. Franken, that was the collapse of the coup, the hardliner coup at the parliament. Goldberg, and? Franken, and that was huge. Do you know that perestroika had been in effect for 6 years at that point? The point here is, Bernie, you regurgitated a quote that you got from some right-wing media watch group, and you did not care to look at the context of it. Listen to how Tom Brokaw opened that evening's news. Good evening. Wednesday, August 21st, 1991. This is a day for bold print in history, to be remembered and savored as the day when the power of the people in the Soviet Union proved to be greater than the power of the gray and cold-blooded men who thought they could return that country to the darkness of state oppression. Boy, it sounds like a real pro-communist bias on NBC, doesn't it? But you know what, Bernie? You didn't even bother to find out what the context of John Chancellor, who, by the way, is dead and couldn't defend himself. You had no interest in finding out the context of what he was saying. I was talking into a camera in San Francisco, so I couldn't see Bernie. But when I watched the tape later, I have to admit I got a real kick out of watching Bernie sitting there silently stewing. He knew he looked like a fool because I was right. He had thrown something in his book without checking it. Frankly, when I had first read the quote in Goldberg's book, I hadn't known the context either. I'm a comedian, but I had a sneaking suspicion that John Chancellor had never been a Stalinist. So I, the comedian, bothered to look it up and get the transcript for the August 21st, 1991 NBC Nightly News broadcast. Brokaw had asked Chancellor about Gorbachev's next move. And what Chancellor was saying was that Gorbachev couldn't use communism as an excuse because, by that point, he had completely dismantled communism in the Soviet Union. Alan Greenspan would have agreed with what Chancellor was saying. And yet Goldberg had accused John Chancellor of, quote, liberal hate speech. Now, I'm on the satellite asking Goldberg to respond, and he can't. So Phil turns to another guest, a right-wing radio talk show host named Jeff Whitaker. Now, Mr. Whitaker, you wanted to say briefly? And Whitaker says, as many examples as Al can pull out, I can pull out a lot of leads into the nightly news. What the hell does that mean? I was talking about Goldberg's book. And that's when I started yelling from San Francisco, I want to hear Bernie. This is about accountability. But nothing from Bernie. And as Phil goes to commercial, I'm still shouting, Phil, why are you letting Bernie off? When I watched the tape a few days later, I realized I may have appeared just a little aggressive. A little later in the show, Donahue took a caller. Donahue. Billy from Tennessee, you waited. I thank you for your patience. What did you want to say? Phil, thank you. I think the main thing I wanted to say is I'm sad that the conservatives you have on tonight have done a poor job of articulating our conservative argument, which I think is another bias of the press, is that you always pick very smart, astute liberals like Al Franken, who are very articulate, and then you have conservatives who scratch their heads and can't come back with something. Donahue, oh well, laughter. Still later, Donahue turned to Bernie and said, quote, you know, I think you've been wounded tonight, kid. He had been wounded, but unfortunately, because I was 3,000 miles away, I wasn't able to shake hands with him after the show and take him out for a drink. If I'd been there, that's exactly what I would have done. And sipping my sake bomb, I would have explained to him what a travesty his book is. It really should have been called Bias. A CBS insider exposes how CBS didn't give him the career he wanted. On 72 of the book's 232 pages, Goldberg settles scores with his old boss, Dan Rather, a representative sample. Quote, if CBS News were a prison instead of a journalistic enterprise, three-quarters of the producers and 100% of the vice presidents would be Rather's bitches. Point, better point. I think Goldberg's most valid point is that reporters tend to have more liberal views than the public on social issues. In one case, Goldberg cites an 18-year-old Los Angeles Times survey of 3,000 journalists nationwide showing that they have more liberal views than the general public on things like gun control. 78% of journalists favored tougher controls 18 years ago, while only half the public did. Prayer in public schools, 74% of the public said yes 18 years ago. 75% of journalists said no. And the death penalty. 18 years ago, 75% of the public supported it versus only 47% of journalists. He fails, however, to explain that editors and publishers who have the final say over what goes out tend to be conservative. According to a study made in this century by Editor and Publisher magazine, more than twice as many newspapers endorsed Bush as endorsed Gore. Bush endorsing papers accounted for 58% of all national circulation. Besides settling scores, Goldberg draws upon his 28 years of broadcast journalism experience to relate a few telling anecdotes in which people in the newsroom said something liberal-sounding. Apparently, at 12:36 p.m. on April 14, 1999, during a routine CBS weekend news conference call, producer Roxanne Russell had the temerity to jokingly refer to Gary Bauer as, quote, a little nut from the Christian group. Full disclosure, Gary's a friend of mine, is small, a Christian, and not a nut. That was unfair. Thank God CBS didn't broadcast a conference call, because that would have been very biased. I'll admit that from among the hundreds of thousands of hours of broadcast news over the last three decades, Bernie is able to cobble together a few instances of liberally slanted reporting. But even when Goldberg seems to have a point, it still feels just the teensiest bit selective. It's like accusing a library of having a murder mystery bias after only going to the murder mystery shelf. They're all murder mysteries. Worse, most of his examples are about as well-researched as the John Chancellor quote. Why, Bernie asks, if CBS identifies the Heritage Foundation as a conservative think tank, does it not identify the Brookings Institution as a liberal think tank? I don't know, bias? Or could it be because the Heritage Foundation website says their mission is to, quote, promote conservative public policies, while the Brookings website says it is committed to, quote, independent, factual, and nonpartisan research? Why, Bernie wants to know, is Phyllis Schlafly always labeled a conservative? Maybe because the official biography on her Eagle Forum website calls her, quote, a national leader of the conservative movement. Why, Bernie asks on page 57, is Rush Limbaugh referred to as a conservative talk show host, but Rosie O'Donnell is not always labeled a liberal talk show host? At first, I thought that one was a misfire. Rush spends 3 hours a day delivering his patented brand of right-wing folderol. But then I remembered a Rosie show where she interviewed Haley Joel Osment. The kid was supposed to be promoting the Sixth Sense, but he just wouldn't shut up about the earned income tax credit. Bernie has a chapter called The Most Important Story You Never Saw on TV. It's about latchkey kids and working moms, and it is an important story. But if you haven't seen it on TV, it's because you haven't been watching CNN, 11 stories, CBS, 11, NBC, 3, or ABC, 10. When I see something only 35 times, I know the liberal media is trying to keep a lid on it. You know, if there's one thing I associate with liberalism, it's anti-Semitism. And what else could explain the shocking media cover-up of the fact that many Arabs dislike Israel? Goldberg has the goods on this one. His smoking gun? Quote, I learned much more about the atmosphere that breathes suicide bombers from one short article in Commentary magazine than I have from watching 20 years of network television news. The commentary article discusses a hit song in Cairo, Damascus, and the West Bank entitled, I Hate Israel. Why didn't I know this? Bernie writes indignantly. Quote, a computer check soon answered my question. On television, only CNN reported the I Hate Israel story. On radio, NPR did a piece. So did the Christian Science Monitor and the Chicago Tribune. The Los Angeles Times ran a short wire service story. So, in other words, except for CNN, NPR, the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, and the wire services, not one of the liberal media outlets let us know about this important story. Not Fox, not the Wall Street Journal, not the Washington Times, not even the National Review. Where are you, William F. Buckley Jr., you liberal anti-Semite? Actually, a Nexus search reveals that the story was also mentioned in the Washington Post, Boston Globe, Chicago Sun-Times, Buffalo News, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Baltimore Sun, Philadelphia Inquirer, Atlanta Journal and Constitution, etc. But still, William F. Buckley's silence on I Hate Israel speaks volumes. As I said, one of bias's biggest problems is its selectivity. The book came out in December 2001. Now, maybe Bernie doesn't follow politics, but there was a big election the previous year. Looking at the coverage of a presidential election might be a good way to test theories of media bias, don't you think? Say the media was liberal, which candidate would it be nicer to, the Republican George W. Bush or the Democrat Albert Gore? There's not one word in bias about the 2000 presidential election. In my next chapter, I will try to fill this gaping hole with a scientific analysis of just how liberal, or perhaps how conservative, that coverage was. You know, one of the joys of appearing on TV is going through the email you get when you bitch slap a Bernie Goldberg or a Bill O'Reilly. And boy, I got a lot of great email from that Donahue appearance. Most of the comments were of the way to get him or I liked your tie variety, but quite a few were, shall we say, slightly negative. One of my favorites. Saw you on Donahue with your liberal shit. Blow it out your ass, dickhead. I've composed a kind of standard response to email like that. Thank you for your kind email regarding my appearance on Donahue. As you can imagine, I've received so many positive responses that I cannot possibly answer them all personally. But once again, thank you for your kind remarks. The idea is to frustrate them. It's especially gratifying when they respond to my response, like the blow it out your ass guy did. Hey, asshole. I know you read my email because you mentioned Donahue. Blow me. So I emailed him back again. Thank you for your kind email regarding my appearance on Donahue. As you can imagine, I've received so many positive responses that I cannot possibly answer them all personally. But once again, thank you for your kind remarks. Sure enough, a few hours later, another email from my new friend. Franken, you're a joke. So I emailed him back. Thank you for your kind email regarding my jokes. As you can imagine, I received so many positive emails regarding my jokes that I cannot possibly answer them all. But once again, thank you for your kind remarks regarding my jokes. Unfortunately, that was our last correspondence. Chapter 7. The 2000 Presidential Election. How it disproved the hypothetical liberal media paradigm matrix. In order to examine more closely the conservative claims of liberal bias, Team Franken constructed a hypothetical model. Let's say that during the 2000 presidential election, liberals controlled the media and used it in a biased manner. In our hypothetical, we asked how would this liberal media distort the news to ensure that the liberal candidate won the election over the conservative candidate? At the risk of stating the obvious, one of our axioms was that negative press hurts a candidate running for election while positive press helps. Ergo, if the liberal media wanted to help the Democratic candidate, it would run positive stories about him and negative stories about the Republican. Our model became what is called the hypothetical liberal media paradigm matrix. It runs as follows. If the media is liberal and the candidate is Democrat, then the media would help him or her with positive stories. And likewise, if the media is liberal and the candidate is Republican, then the media would hurt him or her with negative stories. With this powerful new tool, the HLMP Matrix, developed here at Harvard with funds from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for Social Justice, we were ready to evaluate in an analytical, unbiased way the media coverage of the 2000 campaign. Before we give you the results, let's look at what some of our friends have to say about the political slant of the media. Ann Coulter: the public square is wall-to-wall liberal propaganda. Sean Hannity: the evidence of bias is overwhelming. Bernard Goldberg: they have a liberal bias.